This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of January, and this Wednesday, President Trump's supporters overran the Capitol building. The president addressed a huge protest crowd at the White House, telling them again that members of Congress were stealing the election from him and urging them to march on the Capitol, falsely claiming he would join them in heading to the Capitol. And so the crowd went and overwhelmed lines of Capitol police officers and forced their way into the building, breaking down doors and taking selfies in places like the Speaker's chair and the House chamber. Five people died, including a Capitol police officer and a rioter who was shot by another Capitol police officer. Members of Congress and the vice president were evacuated, interrupting their process of certifying Joe Biden's win over Donald Trump in the Electoral College. Many Republican members of Congress had made similar claims to the president's, that Biden's winning election results were fake, that the election was stolen, that they didn't want to count Biden's win in states like Arizona and Pennsylvania because of these allegations. Some of them came out to show their support for the rioters who would later storm the building, including Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. After the ransacking, the Capitol Police, with reinforcements from Washington, D.C. Municipal Police and other jurisdictions, eventually succeeded in clearing the Capitol and allowing Congress to resume its business. Biden was officially declared the election winner early Thursday morning. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. On the right is Lanhi Chen. Lanhi is the David and Diane Steffi Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's the Director of Domestic Policy Studies and a lecturer in the Public Policy Program at Stanford. Hello, Lanhi.
Hello, Josh. Good to be with you.
And on the left, Sabeel Rahman is president of Demos. Hi, Sabeel.
Hi, everybody.
So, Lanhi, after this, should the president serve the last week and a half of his term?
You know, my view is that the most important thing the president can do right now is to facilitate the orderly transition of power. And what I fear is that an effort to remove him, an effort to displace him with so little time left in his term will only interfere with that. There's no question he's been remarkably disruptive. There's no question that his words earlier this week were a significant part of what we saw in terms of the violence and the people feeling agitated that they would go to the Capitol and do the things they did. But I think the focus now really does need to be on transition. The focus needs to be on ensuring that come January 20th, we are prepared with a new administration taking power. And I think all the conversations we're hearing about the 25th Amendment and about removal, while I understand why people feel that's necessary, in my view, that would only be further disruptive and, frankly, further divisive action, as we're already quite divided given where things are now.
Sabeel, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that January 20th can't come fast enough. There's so much urgent work that needs to be done. And so we need a real president who is actually leading the country. I think that's right. But the thing is, you know, we have a sitting president who still has all the powers of the office, who actively incited an insurrection and an armed attack on the Capitol. I mean, that is an unbelievable situation that we're in. And Donald Trump cannot remain in office under those circumstances. The reality is he's continued to egg on. He, you know, recorded a video the other night trying to express some sort of more moderation and then started tweeting again this morning. And so when that's the case, we just can't risk that danger. The other thing I just want to say, too, is it's fine and good to say move on, but I don't know what democracy means if we are there are no consequences for a sitting president to incite an insurrection against the government and against a duly elected transition of power. Like, there has to be consequences in order to prevent this type of behavior from happening in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Lanhi, as Sabeel notes there, the president, he did record this video that looked almost like a hostage video in which he said that, in which he condemned the rioters who had overrun the Capitol. The previous day, he'd been talking about how he loved them and that they were special, even though he was also saying that they ought to go home. And then again, this morning, he's tweeted again saying that his supporters will not be disrespected or treated unfairly in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't seem to me that, you know, the president is committing at this point to participating in an orderly and peaceful transition of power, even though he did say that in that video last night. I don't know how what does it entail to ensure that the president does that rather than causing more chaos over the next 12 days?
Well, I think it's going to be a chaotic situation in either case. Look, the president's video, you're right. It did not look like the president himself wanted to say those words. But the fact that he put out that video, the fact that they have indicated that's what they're committed to, I think it's important to hold them accountable for that. I do think it's important to ensure that that transition continues. I would say, by the way, you know, if there would be some effort, if there could be some effort, for example, to ensure that the president would be disqualified from running again, that would be an effort that I think would be more worthwhile potentially than looking at what the consequences are right now. I just feel with so little time left in this term, this would be a different conversation, Josh, if it were happening in mid-November. I completely understand that. But it's January the 8th. Joe Biden will take office on January 20th. And to initiate that process, to go through that process, to put the country through that process, the only option at this point to do that, by the way, in my mind, would be impeachment, because the 25th Amendment, the invocation of the 25th Amendment is not happening. That is something, regardless of how much pressure people put on the vice president, on the executive officers that have been appointed by the president to serve in those positions, that is not happening. That is unrealistic to expect. So I understand the calls again, but given where we are, we have to be realistic about what the reality is and what the most important priority is for these next 2 weeks.
I have personally been skeptical of the 25th Amendment approach as well for a number of reasons, including that it would be an untested use of the 25th Amendment. And there are some ambiguities, like who constitutes a principal officer in the cabinet and gets to vote on whether the president would be removed. So I would be concerned about a situation where the president denies that he has been removed under the power of the 25th Amendment. And then you have two different people purporting to discharge the powers of the office. I tend to agree that that could end up being more chaotic than not doing it. But Lanhee, I'm wondering about, you know, you say that's not going to happen. Another reason is the lack of political willingness on the part of the people who are clearly principal officers of the government. You even have some of them resigning. Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary, Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, they would be among the people it would fall to decide whether to disqualify the president. Instead, they're leaving their jobs. To your point about an orderly transition, if you stayed this long, shouldn't you be staying until January 20th? I don't see what big statement you're making about the morality of the president's behavior by quitting your job 9 days before it was going to end anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point in time, the best thing they could do would be to express their opposition or express their concerns. And by the way, both the DeVos and Chao resignation letters made very clear why they were resigning. They made very clear that they believed the president's behavior was unacceptable. They made very clear that they believed the president's behavior played no small role in the violence we saw the other night. The priority, like I said, I mean, for all of these officials, the priority needs to be to do everything they can to facilitate that. Now, perhaps those secretaries felt like there was plenty of activity happening, that their subordinate officers were doing what they needed to do to facilitate that transition. I don't know. I wasn't in those agencies, and I don't know what drove those decisions. But they obviously felt, for purposes of conscience, as well as for purposes of, you know, let's just say the raw political calculation, they needed to step aside, and that's what they did. And I think you have to accept that they did that as a show of understanding for those who believe what the president did the other day was unacceptable.
Sabeel, I don't know what you make of watching that process from the left. I mean, I think that there are a lot of reasons for Democrats to be heartened to watch the Republican Party tear itself apart over Donald Trump, to watch the emergence of these fights within the party and people standing up and saying how unacceptable this is. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's very late. And there's something that feels especially rich about people who went and, you know, who before the Trump administration were talking about how terrible he would be for some of the reasons that have manifested, and then went to work for it or then became close allies of it on the congressional side and started singing a completely different tune. And then now that Donald Trump is done, or is very nearly done, they can go back to saying the things they were saying 4.5 years ago, sort of like that intervening time had never happened. And then you have some of them giving quotes to newspapers about how challenging it is to go look for a job now as an ex-Trump staffer. I'm a little bit at a loss about what to do with these people.
Right. It's really a remarkable, it's a lot of chutzpah, right, to try to pull this off. There's just gaslighting, Josh, in my view. I mean, look, on the one hand, it's critical for the long-term survival of our democracy. That is how high the stakes are at this moment, that really the entire Republican Party, the entire both parties should be clear that what the president has done is unacceptable and anti-democratic and cannot be tolerated. So, you know, it's better that Elaine Chao is resigning than not. That's true. But that's an incredibly low bar, to your point. You know, I think the bigger issue is, you know, Lanhee mentioned transition. I'm thinking about, like, how do we transition in a way that actually ensures that we have a stable democracy where both parties accept election defeats? And right now you have a whole bunch of people in the Republican Party who have fomented this situation. And then when people actually got killed and things actually happened, now they are suddenly singing a different tune. So, you know, I really hope that when the dust settles and inauguration happens and we have a new administration, I hope that the Lindsey Grahams of the world are in fact held to account for their role in creating this process. I think it's a very different story for someone like Senator Romney, for example, right? Senator Romney, dyed-in-the-wool conservative, was the party's nominee, but also has been very consistent to his great credit and clear about the red lines of the kind of conduct that is not acceptable in the Oval Office. But that's not where the rest of these other Republicans have gone so far, unfortunately.
Yeah, Lonnie, what does that mean in terms of self-examination and moving forward? I mean, you must know a lot of these people personally. I imagine you could have gone to work in this administration if you had cared to. So what do you make of the manner in which all the people who went and made this administration run talk to themselves about why they took that job, why they stayed, and why they're leaving now?
Well, you know, I think it's the same argument that they've used all along, which is that there needed to be responsible people involved in the administration of government. And that they needed to take on those roles. And look, in some cases, I think that's sincere. In some cases, I think it's complete BS. You know, I think people said it to make themselves feel better about what they were doing. You know, but in reality, I think the marketplace sorts this out pretty well. I mean, the conversations that are going on about people not being able to find post-administration opportunities, I do think that there will be some weight associated with people who have served in this administration. Now, that weight will be greater for some than others, but there will be a question people will ask, whether it's a future employer or whether it's just somebody that a former appointee will interact with in the future about the role that they've played and what they did. But I do think it's the case. I mean, the administration is so large. There are so many different positions. There are so many different roles to be played. And there are some important things that did need to get done. I do understand the viewpoint of those who thought they were going in to serve. Now, the question becomes, you know, if confronted with the opportunity to leave, if confronted with the opportunity to take a stand, why didn't someone do that? I think that's a question that only the appointee, the former appointee, is going to be able to answer.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Anna Palmer, one of the founders of Punchbowl News, to talk about what actually happened on the Capitol Hill on Wednesday, how it was the case that these rioters were able to get inside the Capitol building and put people in so much danger. I've been talking with Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution and Sabeel Rahman of Demos. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. The assault on the Capitol on Wednesday was stunning in many ways, but one of the ways it was stunning was that it was possible at all. How is it possible that there was such a failure of the security apparatus at the Capitol building that this kind of crisis was even possible and got to the point where it really could have even been much worse than it was? And to talk about that, Anna Palmer joins us now. Anna is the founder and CEO of Punchbowl News, a new publication covering news in Congress in Washington. She's reported on Congress for many years at Politico, and she wrote a book with her Punchbowl colleague Jake Sherman on Congress during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. Hi, Anna.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So how did this happen? How did the Capitol Police allow these people to do what they did?
Yeah, I think it's going to be something that there's going to be a very long investigation about. It's pretty unfathomable to me, to be totally honest. I've worked in the Capitol for more than 10 years. It is usually a secure place where there are cops, There, I mean, I can't get in without taking my belt off often the time. There's, you know, there's magnometers, there's police almost every, you know, 10 to 15 feet. And this was clearly just a total failure of understanding what the threat was. You know, what I would say is people have been arrested for standing up in a hearing, whereas you had kind of, you know, hundreds of people who just doing massive destruction in the Capitol and nothing was happening. And so, you know, two of my colleagues, Jake Sherman and John Bresnahan, were there for it. It's unlike anything, obviously, that's happened before in recent memory. But just, I mean, we've already seen several people that have been fired over at the sergeant at arms in the House and the Senate and the police chief. I mean, I think there's going to be a massive investigation into this.
And then aside from the people whose direct job is security, what's the mood of members of Congress right now about blame for this? I mean, obviously, the president whipped these people up, sent them to the Capitol. You had members of the body themselves who were pushing the conspiracy theories that were animating these people. Who are members of Congress angry at right now?
I think there's a lot of anger to go around, if I'm being honest. I think the tensions are very high. I think there is a joint frustration from Republicans and Democrats at the police presence and the fact that they were unable to get, you know, the National Guard and others to engage in a much more timely way, and that they were obviously not prepared for this. I do think there is massive frustration among Democrats with some of these key Republicans, but even some Republicans are pretty upset about, you know, the antics of Senator Josh Hawley and Senator Ted Cruz and others in the House who were trying to challenge the electoral results, even though they knew that it wasn't going to happen. And there is certainly a lot of frustration by both parties with the president about what he did, that it was an inappropriate action. And then the fact that even more frustration that it took him quite a bit of time to tweet about it and then comment about it. And not to kind of call these people back.
Lonnie, I think over the years, ever since, not just since he took office, but since he launched his presidential campaign, there's been this question with Republican lawmakers and Republican professionals about, you know, what is too far for Donald Trump? Is the Access Hollywood tape too far? And this, we got another thing that I didn't expect to be on the list of things we'd ask if they were too far, which is, you know, what if the president puts you in personal physical danger by sicking a rioting mob on the building where you work? Elaine Chao is a longtime Republican cabinet official. She's also the wife of Senator Mitch McConnell, who was in the chamber at the time that this happened here. And so I think that drove another level of anger for a lot of these people. I'm just wondering about the durability of that, because there's a lot of stuff that Donald Trump has been forgiven for by Republicans over and over again. And I don't know about the extent to which he intends to remain a relevant political figure. He certainly wants to keep that option open. He's even talked about running for president again. Is that too far for Republicans if he, you know, does something that was maybe going to get you killed?
I don't know. You know, I have said over and over again that I thought something would be the last straw. You know, I said it way back when, you had Trump saying what he did when he came down the stairway or the escalator at Trump Tower, or what he said about Judge Curiel, the judge of Mexican-American descent, during the 2016 campaign. You mentioned Access Hollywood, and you can go back to Charlottesville. I mean, event after event after event. What will be too much? I don't know the answer to that question. But what I do know is that, everyone's got an individual calculus about when they feel they need to speak out. What I am concerned about, of course, is the degree to which Trump continues to have the ability to speak directly to people who would potentially support him and vote for him. And at the end of the day, when you talk about Republican lawmakers and Republican policymakers, the reason they are responsive to Trump in the way they are is because, at least in part, their constituencies are responsive to him. That's the most important point. And so long as he's continued to have the ability to say what he wants to say, even if it's untruthful, there is going to be a constituency for him. And there are going to be policymakers and lawmakers who may say enough is enough and then turn around tomorrow and change course. So I think we have to be prepared for that, because what the Trump era has shown us is that he does have remarkable durability as a politician, remarkable durability as someone who can stick around and still garner an incredible amount of support, given what he's done and given what he said.
And Democrats are talking about wanting to impeach the president with so few days left in his term. Can you lay out for a little bit the clock and mechanics of that? Is the House actually going to vote on impeachment? When could they do that? Would the Senate have to take it up? What is that going to look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's obviously a very compressed timeline when you're talking about 12 days until the end of his term. But I do believe the House will likely come back next week. Speaker Pelosi has basically said that her preference is the 25th Amendment, but barring that, which it doesn't appear that that's likely to happen, that she will move towards impeachment. I think that her caucus is certainly behind her. Today, there's a caucus meet call, at noon or so, where I think she'll probably lay out a plan for what that looks like. You know, and then there's rules. So after, if, you know, there is an impeachment in the House, and I believe that will go forward and that will pass, it would be very interesting to see what some of the Republicans do on that issue. I believe they have one day and then they have to take it up in some shape or form in the Senate. That is going to be what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell does is really the million-dollar question. You know, does he go forward with this? Do they just kind of deal with it very perfunctorily? Because I do think you would see, you know, it wouldn't just be Mitt Romney who potentially would be open to impeachment. Ben Sasse from Nebraska has said he is. And I think you could see some other Republicans also move towards impeachment if it gets to that.
Sabeel, this is something that there had been a little bit of chatter about among Democrats even before Wednesday's incident, talking about the president's phone call to the Georgia Secretary of State, urging him to find 11,000 electoral votes, which got pushed out of the lead of our show lineup today because of what happened on Wednesday. But that was another significant defense on the president's part. And I think the view among most Democrats had been that, you know, just because the president does something impeachable doesn't mean that it makes sense to impeach him, especially at this point, and not wanting to get in the way of Joe Biden's transition process, Joe Biden's first 100 days. You don't want the start of the new administration to be about the old administration. But it feels like what happened in the last few days has forced hands on that. And there's unity among Democrats around impeachment. I guess, what does it look like to have accountability and focus on accountability, not just for this, but for other matters that Democrats feel there needs to be accountability for what happened in the Trump administration, without bogging down the Biden administration, without distracting from whatever positive agenda it is that he intends to focus on in his first few months in office?
Yeah, I think it's an important point because we have a lot that needs to be solved. We have multiple crises underway in real time. You know, we're at a high water mark of COVID deaths continuing. But I think this is one of those things where we don't need a lot of process on this, right? The president live in real time through Twitter and on TV incited an attack on the Capitol. The facts are very clear. And so my own view is there's nothing stopping the Congress from having a vote on articles that are already being drawn up in the House and then moving it immediately to the Senate and having a vote. And in my view, everyone should be voting for the lawful removal of President Trump in order to have that accountability. This shouldn't take more than a day. It shouldn't drag on into the new administration because we have other things to do. And frankly, if it's dragging on, that suggests that people are not actually taking seriously the level and severity of offense. I do think a quick but significant impeachment process will be important for setting a red line, right? Our democracy can't survive in the long run if presidents can keep getting away with pushing the envelope the way President Trump has done and, you know, rely on people's unease with process to give them enough gray zone to get away with literal murder.
Lonnie, you said one thing that made sense to you was trying to bar the president from running again. That you would need the impeachment process to do that, right? There's an option when you impeach remove an official to prohibit them from holding future offices. So is that what you were suggesting ought to be done here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, the challenge with the impeachment process is it would be a very compressed timeline. You would have to have, the House could do it relatively quickly. They do everything pretty quickly. But then on the Senate side, you would have to have a trial of some sort, as we saw back in January when that process happened, and then you'd have to have a vote. I don't know, I'm not enough of an expert to know if that process in the Senate can be compressed, but presuming it could be, if you got to the point where people could vote, for example, on whether to bar him from running again, that would seem to be a more productive option in my mind. What I want to avoid, what I personally believe would be not a waste of time, but a little bit of an exercise at this point, would be going through the motions and not having an outcome that really is meaningful for the long run. It is one thing for people to express their point of view and to say, hey, he ought to leave office now. It's quite another to then have some kind of a remedy for the perception, or at least for the reality, that he isn't fit to continue to serve. And I think that would be a much more useful way of approaching the question than simply saying, this discussion about the 25th, either that or an impeachment process where if the results aren't predestined, don't seem to provide a lot of benefit given that the remainder of his time in office is so short.
I think the point Lanhee made is about the remedy is really important, that I think a big argument for a quick impeachment process is to bar Donald Trump from holding future office. That is really important, actually, because all indications are he's not going to go away as a political force. And it is critical for our long-term democracy that we draw the line and actually stop him from holding office in the future.
Anna, do you have a sense of what the events of the last week or so hold for the beginning of the Biden administration and Joe Biden working with Congress? I mean, one weird thing about looking at this episode and the fury that so many Republicans, especially in the Senate, feel toward the president, is that it looks to me like that might actually improve the environment for Joe Biden trying to build bipartisan coalitions as he works with this Congress. One thing that Democrats have always talked about with Mitch McConnell is the extreme discipline of the Senate Republican caucus under him and their efforts to deny President Barack Obama the benefit of being able to point to bipartisan coalitions on matters. It doesn't look right now like Mitch McConnell has great discipline and control over his caucus. He wasn't able to stop them from pursuing these electoral challenges that he was hoping to not see argued out in the U.S. Senate. And so I'm wondering about the extent to which this actually bodes well for bipartisanship over the next few months.
Well, I think a couple things. One, just taking a step back even from this incident, the fact that Democrats won both of the runoff seats in Georgia, it makes the need to compromise for Joe Biden, the need to really think kind of a little bit smaller because everything was going to have to go through Mitch McConnell. That kind of flips it on its head. So all of a sudden you have an all-Democratic Washington. Instead of potentially having cabinet positions held up and long hearings and different things, I mean, that's a very different scenario for him in terms of getting up and running. I do think, the first quarter, at least, if not his probably first year, which is really when a new president with an all, Democratic Congress can get things done before the midterms, is probably going to be very COVID relief centric. I mean, a lot of the new jobs reports came out today. There is, I could see sometimes of some kind of economic stimulus relief. This fact, the Democrats wanted those $2,000 checks. I would expect that to happen. So I think in terms of what he has to do and who he has to convince, it gets a little bit easier for him. Of course, it's a 50-50 Senate, and Nancy Pelosi only has a 5-seat majority in the House. So it's going to be tricky to thread the needle for Democrats. And I think he's going to get pushed very hard now by progressives to go to the left to say, we've been in this 4-year kind of experience with Donald Trump and Trump Republicanism, and they've done all of these things that they want to kind of have the pendulum swing back pretty aggressively. To me, is Joe Biden able to use this experience, and will Republicans have kind of a reckoning within themselves that, maybe this era of hyperpartisanship isn't the best for democracy and isn't the best for America? I have a hard time seeing that play out. I think at the end of the day, most members are very focused on their own power and very focused on staying in office. And unfortunately, probably for the country, the incentive structure is around being more partisan, because you're only ever really worried about being challenged from either, if you're on the left, by somebody who's more further on the left, or if you're on the right, somebody who's much more conservative.
I've been talking with Sabeel Rahman of Demos, Lanhee Chen of the Hoover Institution, and Anna Palmer of Punchbowl News. We'll be back to talk about those remarkable Georgia Senate election results. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts. Or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is Sabeel Rahman, president of Demos. And our special guest is Anna Palmer, CEO and founder of Punchbowl News. Georgia has its first black senator and its first Jewish senator, and its first Democratic wins in Senate races in 20 years. John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won Tuesday's runoff elections in Georgia, Ossoff by about a point and Warnock by about 2 points. Georgia has this unusual system where there's a runoff between the top two candidates if nobody gets 50% in the general election. Turnout was extremely high for a runoff, almost as high as the presidential election, and higher on the Democratic side than on the Republican side. Black turnout was especially strong. And combined with the growth and leftward shift of Atlanta suburbs, that meant Democrats were able to get over the top. Before we go back and talk about what this very narrow Democratic majority means for policymaking in this Congress and in the beginning of the Biden administration, I was wondering if you could just reflect a little bit on how is it that Democrats got over the top in Georgia and what does it mean for Democratic politics?
Yeah, it's drowned out by so much that has happened in these last few days, but it is such an important story, not just for this election, but for what it suggests for the next many years of our politics, right? I think this is a huge watershed moment because what you're seeing here in Georgia, like what we saw in Arizona and other states back in November, is a different coalition emerging in the South and in the Southwest. If you look at the early turnout numbers, right, Warnock and Ossoff were really powered by incredibly strong turnout and huge margins among young people, people of color, including working class folks as well of all races. And this was really a multiracial working class coalition that resonated with Warnock and Ossoff's message. Now, it was razor thin, of course, but the margins are even a little bit better than Joe Biden's margins, which is interesting. I think what this shows is that the old notion of middle of the road, kind of Republicans light under a Democratic banner, that's not really the model for Warnock and Ossoff. They were very unapologetic about their progressive ideas. They ran on $2,000 relief checks, which we've talked about before. I'm also clear about their commitments to racial and economic justice. But they're very much, you know, sons of Georgia. And I think that's really important. It also shows a model for long-term politics, right? This was not just about one election. This is the product of a decade plus of on-the-ground organizing and mobilizing by folks like LaTosha Brown, Stacey Abrams, Nsay Ufot, right? These are leaders who have been working in communities on the ground to activate those constituencies. And that's a durable shift that I think will continue.
And Lanhee, what are lessons here for Republicans? I mean, obviously, one thing that there's a lot of consternation about in the party is allies of President Trump saying that the elections in Georgia were rigged, President Trump himself saying that, and wondering about the extent to which that dampened turnout on the Republican side. Now, Republicans actually had very good turnout in this runoff, just not as astoundingly good as Democrats had. But at the margin, in a close race, you could see that having been dispositive. But then the other thing is the long-run trend in Georgia, which, you know, in addition to the state diversifying, Republicans have just lost a lot of support in what was once their heartland in Georgia, which is to say, you know, middle to upper income suburbs of Atlanta that have become much bluer. What does it look like for Republicans to try to reverse what caused them to lose in the state of Georgia and not have it just slide farther and farther away from them in the way that Virginia and Colorado have done due to similar demographic changes?
Yeah, I mean, there are some trends in Georgia. You look at Arizona, even parts of Texas, there are trends clearly that Republicans do need to be concerned with that are demographic in nature, that are driving the kinds of changes that may make it more difficult for Republicans to assemble the kind of coalition they need to win electorally. Now, that having been said, you also saw hints of a multiracial coalition developing that's right of center as well in places like, you know, Miami-Dade County and certainly parts of Arizona, parts of Southwest Texas. So there are these really kind of interesting, confusing in some ways messages about the kinds of coalitions that were built and the types of outcomes we saw in this election and what it means. I think going forward, the Republican Party does have to be committed to a few things. First of all, it's got to be committed to being a movement that can articulate what it's for that's beyond just the machinations and thoughts of a single person. I think when a party becomes so closely associated with one figure, and when that figure is so divisive and troubling, as we've seen, that creates a very difficult dynamic. We talked about Georgia. What was clear was, you're right, Republican turnout wasn't bad. It wasn't as good as it could have been. It wasn't as good as it was in a presidential election, and maybe we shouldn't have expected that. But what was clear was that Donald Trump did drive turnout to a certain degree for himself. And so the question is, how does the Republican Party become viable as a party that is not just the party of one man or the party of one man's policies, but more than that, a movement that stands for the kinds of things that people can readily identify? And I think the Republican Party is going to have to spend some time thinking through what those things are. You know, is it the traditional party of, you know, markets and opportunity and personal freedom, strong national defense, or is it a party that's some of that with some populism mixed in? And I think that debate is going to be an interesting one that will play out over these next several months and years.
Ada, the Senate will be divided 50-50 once the new senators from Georgia and the new senator from California to replace Kamala Harris are seated. What does that mean in terms of how the Senate will operate? I know this happened 20 years ago. We had an election that produced a 50-50 Senate. So they'll be Democrats have control by virtue of the vice president breaking ties, but there'll be some sort of power sharing?
Yeah, so they've not started negotiating this. We've been reporting a lot about kind of what it was like. That the last time this happened was with Senator Lott and Senator Daschle a long time ago, a bit different era of politics. It took them, I think, about a couple weeks to negotiate that deal. I think that is the baseline for where Senator Chuck Schumer will start the negotiations. But they're going to have to come to an agreement about everything. For example, you know, in the last time this happened was when, if you were at a committee and if it was deadlocked, you know, 50-50, that then they would take the bill to the Senate floor, which then obviously, typically, the party in charge would win. So I think there's going to be a lot of negotiations going back and forth. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure, particularly on Schumer around the filibuster. You know, I think he's going to be hesitant to make any really dramatic moves. But I think Democrats are, it is not lost on them how Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has run the floor for the last 6 years. And there will be, there's a lot of sore feelings about that, particularly around judges and other things. So I think you'll see some Democrats looking for retribution on that and from Republicans and kind of how they handled the floor the last several years.
Ada Palmer, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I want to congratulate you, by the way, on the launch of Punch Bowl News. For listeners who don't follow it, Ada for a number of years has written with her colleague Jake Sherman, Political Playbook. She and Jake and John Bresnahan have now broken off for this new venture.
Yes, absolutely. You can sign up at punchbowl.news.
Thank you, Ada. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Sabil, what does this mean for a progressive agenda? I mean, you can look at some of the people who are going to become committee chairs because of this outcome in Georgia. Bernie Sanders will run the budget committee. Ron Wyden will run the finance committee, which writes tax laws. Sherrod Brown will run the banking committee. These are big gets for progressives. At the same time, anything that you're going to get through the Senate and through those committees, with them being evenly divided, you're going to need to hold on to the most moderate members of the Democratic caucus, or you're going to need to pick up moderate Republicans to support your agenda. So what does it mean for Bernie Sanders to try to write a budget that's likely to need the vote of every Democrat in the Senate? What does this mean for the tug of war between progressives and moderates in the party?
Yeah, I think this opens up a lot more discussion and debate and probably a lot of tension, I would imagine, within the caucus, right, for the reasons that you lay out, Josh, and that Ada talked about. I mean, there's no question that this enables a 50-50 Senate enables a lot more governing to happen in comparison to a scenario where McConnell is blocking everything. So that, I think, is hugely positive, especially because we have some rapid, urgent needs on relief, recovery, on the vaccine, and on democracy reform. But the key in terms of what's in the bills, right, I think it will come down to a negotiation about, you know, what is Senator Manchin willing to sign on to? What are some of the more conservative members of the caucus willing to sign on to? I think this is one area where the Biden administration's careful approach on appointments, I think, signals some of how they might approach the Congress now, right, where, you know, we've seen this sort of balancing act of kind of bringing some new progressive ideas and some new progressive voices, but also trying to bring along the rest of the party and the rest of the country as well. I imagine that's how things will proceed. But the other thing I'll just say too is our political and policy conversation has changed a lot over the last 10, 15, 20 years, even over the last 4 years, right? And so, you know, it's now, I think, pretty widely believed among the caucus that we need some kind of major democracy reform, that we need something to deal with our inequality crisis, that we obviously need something to happen quickly on the COVID crisis. And so I think some of the tensions that we saw in the past might actually go somewhat more smoothly in the sense that, you know, there's a lot more agreement on some basic new ideas.
And so, Lonnie, what does that mean for Republicans in this Senate? It's likely, even though Democrats have this bare majority, there's still going to need to be a lot of bipartisan work. To the extent that the filibuster is kept for legislation, then there are going to be certain things that need 60 votes to get through. And while Democrats could get rid of the filibuster with a simple majority, it's not clear that they have agreement among all 50 members of their caucus in order to do that. What does it look like for Republicans to negotiate here, or should Democrats be right to fear that you're going to see sort of a legislative blockade and that Biden's going to have to find ways either to do things once a year through the budget reconciliation process, which is a legislative process that allows you to move through the Senate with just a bare majority, and then through appointments and executive actions, or are there big opportunities for legislative negotiation here?
Yeah, I'm actually relatively optimistic that moderates on both sides of the aisle are the ones who are going to be boosted. And I think history demonstrates the degree to which moderates can exert a tremendous amount of influence, even when the margins aren't as narrow. I mean, you look back to the debate over the Affordable Care Act in 2010, really what got that piece of legislation across the finish line was moderates. Now, Democratic moderates were the ones in the driver's seat there because of the nature of the margin. But given where we are now, I do think you're going to see some moderates in the Republican Party boosted. And I do think that their instinct, their natural proclivity is going to be to try and work with Biden and with Democrats to try and get a few things done. So people like the aforementioned Mitt Romney, Susan Collins of Maine, who won re-election, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, even Rob Portman of Ohio, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. I mean, this was the group, after all, that broke the logjam on COVID-19 relief legislation. So I have some measure of confidence that we are going to see, at least early on, some bipartisanship when it comes to issues like COVID-19 relief, continuing efforts to fight the pandemic, infrastructure spending, even some elements potentially of healthcare and economic policy. So I do think that there are some areas of agreement that if Biden and the Democrats exercise goodwill and demonstrate a desire to work with Republicans, there will be a reciprocation from a few of those, at least enough to make a difference. You know, Biden and the Democrats don't need all the Republicans. They don't even need a majority of the Republicans anymore because Chuck Schumer will be in charge of the floor and what goes on the floor. Reconciliation, which you mentioned, is not really that effective of an option because the things you can use reconciliation for at the end of the day are relatively limited to those that have more than an incidental impact on spending and taxation. So it is going to require a supermajority, and it is going to require working together, and I think that could happen.
Sabeel, I've seen news reports about that the Biden administration is intending to move quickly on another COVID relief package, including $1,400 checks to sort of plus up the $600 that Congress approved in the last package to produce those $2,000 checks, and then wants to later in the year, through reconciliation, move a big tax and infrastructure package, trillions of dollars. And so I guess the things I wonder about that are the extent to which that if you do that, that's largely going to be either deficit increasing stuff, or if it's not deficit increasing, that's because there are tax provisions in there that Republicans are likely to object to. So I'm wondering, is the hope to do a bipartisan COVID relief bill and then use the threat of reconciliation to say we can do this all with Democratic votes? It feels like that's going to be a pretty narrow needle to thread if that's the legislative strategy for the Biden team.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen those reports as well, and you know, I'm not sure exactly what they're planning from a strategic standpoint. But you know, I think part of this is that I of the view that we shouldn't have a Senate filibuster in the first place, precisely because it forces all these kinds of legislative maneuvers and deals that just slows down the process of governing. Now that aside, you know, there's been pressure on the Biden administration to come out in favor of the abolition of the filibuster. I don't know if they'll go that far. I do think they'll do a lot through reconciliation, as you mentioned. But, you know, I think that they're going to try to use certainly an infrastructure package and a relief package to have as much immediate impact on the economy as possible. I think they're well aware of how dire the situation is. And, you know, I also think that they're aware that their ability to respond to the economic crisis right now is going to influence heavily what happens in 2022 in terms of keeping or even expanding these majorities, which will be hard in an off-year election. So I think they're going to try to move as much as they can through these. On the deficit question, you know, we're in a situation of incredibly low interest rates where all the economics and social science makes really clear that actually deficit spending is even more efficient at this point when you think about what it's being spent on, right? Especially if it's being spent on the kind of economic relief and durable infrastructure investments that will jumpstart the economy post-COVID. So I don't think that's really an issue. There has been some discussion about, you know, different tax proposals. The Biden team had ran on, you know, some increases of taxes on corporations and the wealthy that are, you know, pretty modest by historical standards, but that would finance some of these proposals. So I imagine we'll see those rolled out again in the coming months.
Yeah, Lanhi, I mean, one of the traditional ways to build bipartisan coalitions in Washington is, you know, sort of something nice for everyone on the Christmas tree in the bill, and you get a highway in your district, and you get a highway in your district. And during the Trump administration, Republicans have embraced deficit-increasing policies, including the tax cuts. Once the COVID crisis hit, we had these very large relief packages that ran up very large budget deficits. And then you saw a lot of Republican support for these checks to most households, including from Josh Hawley, the main character of this week. And so I guess the question is, for me, is the extent to which that's going to persist into a Democratic administration with a normalizing economy. Is that a way to build bipartisan deals here? Because I can imagine a return to something like in the Obama administration, where the singular rhetorical focus of Republicans is how big the budget deficit is and that we need big, you know, big government spending cuts to close the budget deficit, but not a lot of interest in tax increases in order to fix the budget deficit. Now, there are some quirky things about the way the tax law was written. There are provisions that would need to be reauthorized. That might give a lever to Democrats trying to cut a deal with Republicans on taxes. But it seems like there would be an opportunity here for Republicans to just go back to basically saying, we don't want to spend money on anything because the deficit is so big.
Yeah, I do think you are going to find that a few Republicans sort of, refined themselves fiscal conservatives. I do think that's the case. But I also think that the discussion, Josh, within the Republican Party has shifted a little bit. And this gets back to some of our earlier conversation about what the future of the GOP looks like. I do think that you have a substantially larger number of Republicans who have staked their policy visions to, frankly, a more significant and expansive role for the federal government. And you saw that in the debate over $2,000 stimulus checks. You've seen that over the conversation about, you know, is there more government needs to be doing to help working Americans? And I think that conversation is one that has shifted the nature of where the Republican Party is. It's not all Republicans. You still have a considerable number, probably a majority of the Republican conference in the Senate, for example, as traditional adherents of, let's call it the more market-based perspective, which you might find on the Wall Street Journal editorial page. But you also have a significant number who I don't think are going to change their minds about what they believe needs to happen. And that's part of the interesting debate that's going to happen going forward. And the opportunity, frankly, for Biden and for his team and for Democrats in the Senate to create coalitions that aren't necessarily stable in the sense that you might have one coalition supporting one piece of policy and a different Republican coalition working with Democrats to support a different policy. So it is going to be incumbent, I think, on Biden and the Democrats to figure out which Republicans they can pick off, which Republicans they can work with in any given situation. Because you know what? It's not going to be the same Republicans on every piece of legislation. And I think that'll make people who watch these things, it'll make it for an interesting conversation over these next several months and years.
One of the other really important things about Democrats winning these two Senate seats has to do with appointments that Joe Biden will make to courts and to his cabinet and to his administration. He will not need to rely on Mitch McConnell to be willing to bring those nominees to the floor. And so that, I think, means he has a much freer hand. I think Neera Tanden is going to get confirmed to run the Office of Management and Budget now. Sabeel, what does this mean in terms of personnel? Are there choices that Biden either has made or you think is likely to make will give progressives things that they wouldn't have gotten if they had not gotten control of the Senate?
Yeah, I think it's possible that it might open up a few more sub-cabinet appointments, right, that are a bit more on the progressive side. But I think the biggest change here is the ability to actually move quickly. So, you know, it's a very different scenario if you're planning for a kind of long scorched earth confirmation process for your cabinet. It's incredibly hard to govern, right, without the cabinet in place, especially after the evisceration of the civil service and a lot of the leadership that we saw under the Trump administration. So I think the biggest change here is less about a moderate to left spectrum move for the administration, but actually opening up their ability to move more quickly, get those cabinet appointments and sub-cabinet appointments confirmed, and then actually start moving a regulatory and legislative agenda that responds to things, right? So I think it's really more about time on the clock that it opens up.
What do you make of the choice of Merrick Garland to be Attorney General? I mean, one interesting aspect of that is that it opens up Merrick Garland's seat on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and now Biden will be able to make that nomination to that very powerful court into a Senate that's likely to approve it. But what do you think that means in terms of justice policy in this administration?
Yeah, it's interesting that was leaked and then announced, you know, virtually immediately after the Georgia results became clear, right? And to me, what that says is that President-elect Biden wanted Merrick Garland for the DOJ all along, but maybe was holding back because he's afraid of losing the chance to actually fill Garland's soon-to-be vacant seat. With a Democratic control of the Senate, now that becomes much easier. So, you know, I read that appointment for the DOJ as really trying to accomplish two things. One, bring in someone who has very strong credibility and legitimacy across the partisan spectrum, who can reestablish the Department of Justice's independence. That's so critical after what happened with Bill Barr and Trump, and even just the events of the last week makes it so clear that we really need a legitimate and independent Department of Justice that can enforce the laws and particularly enforce civil rights, voting rights, and accountability laws. But the second thing that I saw with President-elect's picks is he also brought in some really amazing leaders in the civil rights and voting rights community as part of the team. So if you're looking not just at the deputy Lisa Monaco, but Vinita Gupta and Kristen Clark, Gupta and Clark are among the leading voices in civil and voting rights, which to me suggests that that's going to be a big focus for this new Department of Justice under Garland.
Lanhee, it will still be a 50-50 Senate, and Republicans will still have a significant say if there are picks that Biden makes that have no Republican support. He will need to hold on to every Democratic member. And so, as you look at the choices that he is making, are there places that you think Republicans are going to make stands on personnel, or does this basically mean that Biden has a free hand to staff his administration as he sees fit?
Yeah, I think it means Biden basically has a free hand. That doesn't mean I don't think Republicans won't raise objections in cases where they feel like they need to make those objections. You know, I've talked to a number of Republicans in the Senate, for example, who intend to express their views that Javier Becerra of California is not, you know, not the right pick for HHS secretary. At the end of the day, I think he gets confirmed, but they do intend to express a point of view that in the middle of a pandemic, having someone with essentially zero health policy and public health experience taking the reins at the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, some have expressed a desire to put out a point of view about Neera Tanden, which we've talked about already, and it wouldn't surprise me if that happened. So I do think they're going to pick their spots to express opposition. But at the end of the day, the Democrats' triumphs in Georgia ensure that Joe Biden will be able to staff his administration as he wants. And you know, we'll have to see, Josh, going forward on judicial nominations. I think that there may be some judicial nominations where Republicans try to put their foot down. But overall, it also means that Joe Biden is going to have a relatively free hand to install Article III judges to the extent that he sees fit and to put in place people who he believes are qualified to serve in the judiciary, which I think would be an interesting counterpoint to what we've seen for the last several years, which is Donald Trump has turned the judiciary considerably more conservative over the last couple of years. And so Biden will have his opportunity now, beginning on January 20th.
Yeah, Sabeel, Justice Stephen Breyer is 82 years old. Is there going to be pressure on him to resign, create a Supreme Court seat for Biden to fill promptly?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen some chatter about that, you know, in terms of op-eds and commentary and stuff. You know, obviously, Justice Breyer served with distinction and, you know, gets to decide the terms of his own tenure here. But I do think that, you know, it's just better practice to do so. We're having a debate. We were having a debate with Justice Ginsburg's death about how to reform the Supreme Court. You know, my own view is we should have fixed terms and staggered terms so that you take the randomness out of judicial appointments. But I think, you know, Justice Breyer should at least consider, what it means for the long-term durability of the court to have, whether he wants to stay on for, another 4, 8 or 16 years, right, whatever it might be. I think there'll be a lot of conversation about that. But, you know, again, the judiciary is independent, so is the Supreme Court, and Justice Breyer will make his own call on that.
I think he should retire, and I think people should be less polite about this. I think that it was a huge mistake that Ruth Bader Ginsburg stayed on the court as long as she did. Fundamentally, the court is about us. It's not about its members. After that mini rant from me, we have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Lonnie Chen, what's your rant?
California's unemployment insurance system is completely broken. It's supposed to be a safety net, one that's become particularly stretched during the economic shutdowns associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. But today's news, the system is now experiencing a mass suspension of payments. Over 1 million claims are on hold while the system tries to root out massive fraud that has even led to payments to Senator Dianne Feinstein, or more precisely, a former state employee illegally posing as her. This comes in addition to another 780,000 backlog claims as of the end of 2020. It's long past time for California's leaders to fix this broken system once and for all, but no one in Sacramento is really willing to accept responsibility. That's shameful, because the people who are being hurt are those who could most use the help during these challenging times.
Sabil Rahman, what's your rant?
In the face of the attack on the Capitol, Twitter and Facebook at long last took the step that people have been pushing for a long time of blocking the President Trump's ability to post on their media. And it just underscores what has been true for years, that the platforms are essentially engines for disinformation, misinformation, and the fanning of radical extremism, not just here, but around the world. In the long run, it's going to be critical that the platforms actually take responsibility for their involvement in inciting violence at home and abroad, and that we have a different public policy for how Twitter and Facebook are governed in the future.
For my rant, the mayor and the governor of New York are fighting. This isn't new. They do this all the time. It's exhausting. But now they're fighting because the mayor wants more flexibility to administer COVID vaccine shots to more kinds of people, like police officers and people over 75. The city says shots are going to waste, and the pace of vaccination has been slowed down because of the difficulty working in the very specific order that the state requires them to in giving out those vaccinations. The delays are in part because some eligible healthcare workers in the first phase are declining the shots that are being offered to them. But the state and Governor Cuomo are saying no. They're saying they've prescribed this order for a reason and that the city should find eligible people to take these shots or they'll redistribute them and send them somewhere else. This is a problem that we're seeing all over the country. Complicated rules with good intentions about who to vaccinate first, slowing down the vaccination process as you tie people up in knots trying to go in this order. New York has used threats to try to move this faster. The New York State threatening to fine hospitals if they don't administer vaccines enough, but also threatening to fine them if they give vaccines to the wrong people. Is it any surprise that speed is being sacrificed in that context? We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. The number one goal has to be to get vaccines in arms as fast as possible, and especially in places like New York City, where you have a really expansive, well-funded public health apparatus. You need to trust the officials on the ground to use their judgment, use their local knowledge to figure out how to get the vaccines out as efficiently and quickly as possible, even if it sometimes means going out of order. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Lonnie Chen, Sabil Rahman, and Anna Palmer. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.